here to talk about this book you've written about the history of the colonial experience, the early history of Roman Catholics here in North America, in a book called Continental Ambitions. And a lot of us as kids, especially growing up in the United States, we learn about the history of the United States and maybe a little bit more about North America. And when we talk about the pilgrims, you know, we would talk about how they were trying to escape religious persecution in England. But in this book, it becomes a lot more obvious that it really started long before Plymouth Rock.
And well, that's true, Ken, and this is why I devoted so many years to putting this story together, because it's never been fully put together the way I've tried to do it in Continental Ambitions. We Catholics, we American Catholics, tend to have a historical concept of ourselves as sort of Johnny-come-latelys, whose existence only really gathers momentum during the great period of immigration, the 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s, or through the 19th century. And actually, as I show in my book, that's not the case. From 1100 to the mid-1400s, for example, there was a Christian Scandinavian culture, Catholic Christian Scandinavian culture, in Greenland, which is only 6 days' sail from Newfoundland. And there was a bishop there, a cathedral at Gardar, a Benedictine monastery, an Augustinian priory, and a Catholic population. And so therefore, I mean, we are as old as any, we are the oldest European entrada, to use the Spanish word, into North America. And I think that's important for us, not out of any vainglory, but to say that in the creation of the whole national culture, three national cultures of North America, Mexico, the United States, and Canada, in the creation of those three cultures, the Catholic element was the foundational element after the indigenous people, but as far as European intervention was concerned. And I think that's an important story to tell. Now, not necessarily because you compete and say, oh, St. Augustine, the Catholics founded Florida, St. Augustine, Florida in 1565, and Jamestown wasn't founded until nearly 50-plus years later. It's not that we do that, but that we come to a psychological realization that the Catholic experiment, the Catholic community, Catholic peoples have been part of the warp and woof of the emergence of North America from the beginning.
And in all of your research and in your own estimation, why is it that do you think that the Catholic history has not been brought forth before perhaps your book's been written?
Well, it has been put. It has been put forth in fragments. For instance, I integrate four cultures, actually. Just one chapter on Catholic Scandinavia and Greenland. I have many chapters on the Hispanic, a New Spain, and the Las Floridas, and the Spanish Southwest, and the Californias. And I have a whole section on New France, because it's important for us English-speaking Roman Catholics, predominantly in the United States, to realize the highly developed nature of French Catholicism in the 17th and early 18th century is part of our usable past as well. So it's not as if there aren't individual studies of Maria the Incarnation, recently canonized, or Bishop Laval, recently canonized, or Junipero Serra, recently canonized. There are individual biographies and studies, but what I did was put it all together into one interconnected narrative. Now, to answer your question even further, Ken, the history is the American history, English-American history, American history written in English, tend to be written initially by New Englanders. And they obviously would emphasize the Puritans and the Pilgrims and the New England past, which dates from the 1620s. They obviously would do that. They're not going to go back to Coronado's entrance into New Mexico in 1539 or 1540, or De Soto's expedition into the interior of the continent in 1539, or the migration, really, of Cabeza de Vaca and his companions from Florida to Mexico City in the 1520s. That is so remote from them, but that's part of our usable past, as part of the Catholic foundations, I think it's important for us to have that psychologically in mind.
No, and I would agree with you, because I know as a cradle Catholic that not that we're necessarily put down, but especially current politics, when there's a lot of talk about religious freedom and those types of things, this isn't something now in our own mind in the previous show that you might have caught the tail end of while you were waiting to come on. We were talking about St. John Newman, a local saint here in Philadelphia.
Oh, and, of course, a great saint.
Right. So, and we talk about the Catholic faith in on the East Coast here, which was really in your book would be John Carroll in Annapolis, and occurring in the late 1600s, and it really goes back further and. In my mind now, plays even a larger role in the foundation of not just the United States now, but also Canada and Mexico.
Well, when you look at Philadelphia, for instance, and you look at the founding of St. Mary's, St. Joseph's Church, and then St. Mary's Church, right. In the mid-18th century, later St. Augustine's Church by the Augustinian pioneers, it is remarkable thanks to the good feeling that the Quakers had and the toleration Quakers had for Catholics. They didn't hold the kind of restrictions against Catholics and other than the colonies. It's remarkable the Catholic civilization that grew up in Philadelphia and the German-speaking Catholic population that grew up in southern Pennsylvania along the Maryland border. I think that's an important thing for us to remember. And incidentally, those churches are still operating. Still, of course, St. Joseph's has become, of course, St. Joseph's University, and St. Mary's is a national shrine. But I deal quite a bit with Philadelphia and with Pennsylvania, which next to Maryland, is the most Catholic of the early pre-Revolutionary War commonwealths.
So, in this history, and you mentioned a number of the explorers that would come. Whether from Spain or France and later Britain, were they coming from Europe to necessarily evangelize, or were they coming for other reasons?
Ken, you asked the question with which I wrestle with the entire book, because the motivations were mixed. That's why I called my book Continental Ambitions, because these ambitions were ambitions for the fur trade, their ambitions for settlement, their ambitions for the discovery of gold. They were also ambitions for evangelization of the indigenous people. And I think this crystallizes itself very early when Columbus came back from his first voyage. He brought back and showed Queen Elizabeth some of the Native Americans, the Caribbean people that he had brought back. Let's call it as slaves. And Queen Elizabeth said, I didn't send you to the New World. I didn't send you to the Indies to enslave these people. I sent you there to evangelize them. And she made Columbus bring these Native Americans back and release them back into their homelands. So these are ambitions moved together. You can't have one without the other. And even, for instance, a great missionary like Eusebio Kino, who was a Jesuit missionary of northern Mexico, Arizona, coming into Baja California, is also by a cattle rancher, a agriculturalist, because you've got to get people to live here. And I emphasize lay people as not equal to missionaries. It's a different calling altogether. They're in my father's house, there are many mansions. But I talk about the idea of getting women, Catholic women, to come to the New World, Catholic families to be formed, Catholic parishes to be established, and that's a very long and patient work to do. So it's a total mixture. It runs a gamut from the most spiritual, detached ambitions in the hearts of saints to business people, to explorers, and also I do not gild over when there's failure. There's some real tragic interactions between explorers and developers, Catholic developers and Native American populations. We've got to face that too. That's part of our tragic past. We Catholics are not exactly unaccustomed to the concept of sin, because we also have the concept of redemption from sin. So I put the cultural sins, the sins we committed against the indigenous peoples, I put those in there as honestly as possible.
Very good. Very good. Dr. Kevin is going to be with us for a little while today to talk about this book. I'd like to encourage you, if you have questions, maybe you've done your own reading and study of the history of the Catholic Church here in North America, and perhaps you have a question for Dr. Starr, you can reach us here at 610-527-2906. That's 610-527-2906. Or if you're listening over the internet and perhaps a distance away, you can reach us at 888-343-2484. That's 888-34-FAITH. So maybe a little bit in each of the areas, Dr. Starr.
We'll start with New Spain, because that's first, of course, Columbus coming in 1492 into the Caribbean. And New Spain, the initial effect of the development of the Caribbean on the Native American population there is very devastating, because under the doctrine of encomienda, the labor of the Native Americans was appropriated in the mines, and it was really a very disastrous result, because these people were not used to that kind of heavy labor. And I begin my book in 1510 in the cathedral in Hispaniola, when Fray Montesinos, a Dominican, stands up, and he's got the entire establishment of New Spain there, and he stands up and says that we must do right, better, we must do right, we must do redemptive work with the Native Americans here, or God will punish us. And I go from there into the culture of developed by Bartolomeos de las Casas, one of the great heroes of the struggle for Indian rights in the 16th century, later Bishop of Oaxaca. Las Casas came himself as a farmer, a developer to Hispaniola. He later became a secular priest, and he at one point was offering prayers and wanted to offer some prayers, and he realized you can't really, he remembered the passage from Ecclesiastes, that you can't really offer to God the fruits of the earth unless you participated somehow in the work that brought those fruits of earth to the point of being sacrificed. In other words, you don't sacrifice the labor of other people. You sacrifice your own labor. And that the scales fell from his eyes. He joined the Dominican Order and became a great, great champion, both in the Caribbean and back in Spain, on behalf of the eventual righting of the relationship, the correction of the relationship between the Hispanic settlers and the indigenous people. It didn't all happen during his lifetime, but he set it in motion. Then I go into the entrance into Florida, Las Floridas, because that's very early, the 1520s, and I take that up until the founding of St. Augustine, or St. Augustine, but we Catholics tend to say St. Augustine, right, in 1565, the coming of an auxiliary bishop from Havana with a temporary residence in Florida. So we have our first Episcopal organization there. And then, of course, I mentioned Cabeza de Vaca, the very power of the continent, of that great continental trek that he and his three companions took that transformed them and turned Cabeza de Vaca into a great champion for Indian rights as well as a great mystical healer figure. And then I move into, obviously, the various components. New Mexico in the 1690s up until the founding of Santa Fe in 1590s, rather, in Santa Fe in 1610. And one of my favorites, because it's not that well known, is the Franciscan missionary effort in Texas. It starts in the 1720s and is very highly successful in terms of the establishment of modern-day Texas. And then, of course, being myself a Californian, I come over to Arizona or Primera Alta with Kino, and then into Baja California with the Jesuits and Franciscans coming into Alta California in 1769, the establishment of San Francisco 1775. So you have basically a continental ambition that extends itself from St. Augustine, Florida, to San Francisco, across the vast lower reaches of the American continent that is highly Hispanic in population. And I look in each case, how do we get women to come over? Hispanic women didn't come over from Spain that easily. And when women don't come over and you don't have family life and children, you don't have parish life, it's very difficult to establish a stable Catholic culture. So I look at the eventual Christianization of many Native American peoples and the emergence of a brand new race of people, the Mexican people, and the people of the Spanish Southwest. I look at their art. I look at the Santoses to sort of gauge that marvelous interaction of Hispanic civilization and Native American civilization. And then I take up in 1606 New France. Now, the thing about New France, in the St. Lawrence Valley is how highly developed Catholic culture became there. If we were visiting Quebec, which is founded about approximately 1609, 1610, if we were visiting Quebec 50, 60 years later, there would be a cathedral. The Jesuits would have a four-story college with professorships. The Sisters of the Mercy of Jesus, the Hotel Dieu, the Hospital Sisters of the Mercy of Jesus, would have a magnificent hospital which still functions today to this day in Quebec. If we went up the river a little bit, we'd come across Quebec. We'd come across Montreal, a spectacular city founded by out of the parish of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, and flourishing as well as a great center of trade, commerce, and Catholic culture, and the headquarters of the Sulpician order in North America. So I think that's part of our usable past, to look at that, and to look at the very successful patterns of interaction between the French and the Native American populations, with the exception, of course, of a long European war with the Iroquois, and between Europeans and Iroquois, which eventually has ended successfully by the late 18th century. So then down to Maryland, which is a Catholic colony granted to English Catholics by the great Anglo-Catholic Charles I, of course, who was martyred during the Civil War, granted Lord Calvert the right to have a Catholic colony. He cut off part of Virginia and Maryland on the Chesapeake, and from there I go into southern Pennsylvania and Philadelphia to end my story, really, just on the verge of the Revolutionary War in 1774.
Very good. And, you know, as you're going through it, I'm just going through the table of contents, and you went straight through it. As far as how it would grow, it sounds like it would be a constant flow of new people coming. So it wasn't that the Spanish would come to the southern part of North America, and it was the same ones that would start on the East Coast and work their way to the West Coast. It sounds more like word would go back to Europe that we've gotten so far, we need more, and additional
Absolutely
folks from can. Europe
people
would come.
People would come from various parts of the Spanish Empire in general. People would start coming from Portugal as well into Texas, Germans into Texas, as I mentioned, Germans into Pennsylvania. And for instance, it was very difficult to get French women, young French women, to come to French Canada. It was a tough place to be. The winters were 6 months long. It could be very difficult. So Talon, in cooperation with the Ursuline sisters, Talon was the chief civil servant of New Canada, French Canada, said, look, we've got all these young women who are the second and third daughters of farming families. These are first-rate young Catholic women. They don't have a dowry. They're going to have to live a kind of Cinderella life with their older sisters, because they will never have a farm of their own. If they come to the New World, and if they marry, we don't force them to marry or marry anybody in particular, but we'll pay for their fare, we'll buy the young couple a farm on the St. Lawrence, we'll give them money to stock the farm with tools and equipment. My goodness, some 3,000 young women took up that offer over a period of about 30 years. They were met by the Ursuline sisters in the port of Quebec, brought up into the convent Ursuline, and of course, observing all the proprieties of introducing them. I always thought of them, when I was writing this up, I thought of college mixers in the 1950s, where the Catholic schools would give mixers for the different Catholic kids in one school or another. And from that program, my goodness, 100 years later, you have a new people, not French colonials, but French Canadians, who had become totally men and women of the country, and extraordinary devout and creative Catholics as well.
You know, it's interesting as you're explaining that, because I think, and maybe I don't think I'm alone in this view, but you know, the way we're brought up is that there were Native Americans, and those Native Americans, whether they were in Canada or the United States or even Mexico, that the Europeans would come and would overtake, annihilate, send off the reservations, the native people that were here. And the way you're explaining it is that it may have been that way in some circumstances, but yet there were others where they would come and combine, if you will, for lack
That's
of a
right.
better word.
That happens two or three times in the Spanish Southwest. But when it does, the government of New Spain in Mexico City investigates and brings to punishment the people responsible for these massacres. In the case of New France, far from standing off with the Native Americans, the Ursuline sisters used to take young Indian girls, young women, and educate them in French. And they had to make an allowance, so every so often the young ladies, the young Mohawk, not Mohawk, but Huron or Mi'kmaq youngsters, especially the Hurons, though, would get homesick and have to go home for a while and live out in the forest before they came back again. But there was every effort to create a bridge culture that would incorporate the best possibilities of the indigenous culture with the new possibilities being brought by French Catholicism. And that was extremely typical of New France as a deliberate program. In the case of the Spanish Southwest, in the case of Mexico, it happens almost spontaneously as the influence of the church exercises itself and proper marriages occur between indigenous women and Spaniards. And my goodness, by the time of the Spanish colonial period in Mexico, you have a brand new people on the planet, the Mexican people, who are extraordinarily diverse in their ancestry, but more or less organized around a combination of Spanish and indigenous bloodlines.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And in the Spanish areas, and in particular in Mexico City, because last month we celebrated the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who had with Juan Diego, and wondering if how much of that is that mentioned at all in your book, or is that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because that becomes the icon of self-identification, Our Lady of Guadalupe. And I go into that. Ken, you've asked a very powerful question, because the Franciscan missionaries. Were very much, and the Dominican missionaries, but especially the Franciscans, were very much taken up by the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, that Mary was conceived without sin and exists as a perfected type of humanity. And they had a special devotion to that. So obviously they were prepared for the emergence then of Mary as the image of, because if you look at the Our Lady of Guadalupe, I guess it was initially a scapular upon which the image was created. This is an Indian, a young Indian woman. Mm. She's dressed in Indian clothes, and yet she is Mary, the type of perfected humanity conceived without sin. So that's a powerful sacred symbol. It's a powerful emblem of identity of a new people.
Very good. Dr. Starr, we're at the bottom of the hour. I just want to take a short break, and before I do, I want to give out our numbers again if anybody wants to join the conversation, or perhaps you have a question for Dr. Starr about the Catholic history here in North America. You can reach us at 610 527 2906. That's 610-527-2906. Or if you're listening from a distance, it's 888-343-2484. That's 888-34-FAITH. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This is Mike Balmazy of Villa Joseph Marie High School. I've been a listener to Kathleen McCarthy and her radio station and his sign ministry for years. And I can never say enough good things about Kathleen. Her insightfulness, her dedication to the church, her love of the Holy Spirit, and the beautiful way she expresses herself as a daughter of the church and as a daughter of Mary deserves to be listened to, deserves to be praised. And I can't encourage you more than to do what you can for New Side Ministry. God bless.
Have you ever heard of seed faith, the biblical law of sowing and reaping? Many people fail when it comes to faith for finances because they haven't planted any seed. Any farmer knows that if you want a good crop, you have to first sow the seed. The Bible speaks about seed right from the beginning in Genesis, and it's brought up all throughout the scriptures. In the second book of Corinthians, we are told that whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, but whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Why not consider sowing your financial seed into In His Sign Catholic Radio, a ministry with a 30-year history? You should sow your financial seed into a ministry that produces good fruit. Luke tells us at chapter 6, verse 44, every tree is known by its fruit. You should sow your financial seeds where you're fed, be it here, your local parish, or other worthy ministries. Please prayerfully consider joining our monthly circle of family and friends by partnering with us financially each month. All donations are completely tax deductible and go directly to our daily expenses, like the purchase of radio airtime and keeping the lights on. Kathleen McCarthy and all of the staff at In His Sign, except Kathleen's administrator, donate all of their time and talent on a volunteer basis at no expense to the ministry. Donations to In His Sign Catholic Radio may be sent to 136 Garrett Avenue, Rosemont, PA 19010. Or you can donate securely at inhissign.com. Remember, without your prayers and financial support, our mission voice will be silenced.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. This is Ken Johnston, your host, for the next 30 minutes anyway, or 27 minutes I guess we have left. And I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners once again, and thank you for your ongoing support. As we mentioned on most shows, we can't do it without you, and we just ask that you would continue that support. The easiest way to do it is to go to the website, inhissign.com, and click on that donate button. You can either make a one-time donation or opt for a monthly donation. It'd be great to have you join that monthly circle of friends. We remember you at our monthly Mass and celebrate God with you and for you and for all you do for us here at In His Sign Ministry. So we're talking to Dr. Kevin Starr. He's written this wonderful history called Continental Ambitions, Roman Catholics in North America, The Colonial Experience. It's published by Ignatius Press, and I'm assuming the best way to get it is by going to Ignatius.com. Is that right, Doctor?
Ignatius.com or Amazon.com, too, has handling it very successfully. If you notice, Ken, if I say so myself, how beautifully illustrated the book is. Those illustrations are relatively expensive, but I got a grant from a Catholic foundation that prefers not to be mentioned. But they were so enthusiastic about the book that they made me a grant that I was able to afford, as you can see, these 44 great colored depictions, which, of course, given the fact that I'm dealing with the era before photography, it's very tough to come up with proper depictions, and I'm very proud of that side of things. We're very reader-friendly.
And I can
I also break the book down into chapters, and each chapter is complete, so this is not a book that you have to read and then you break off in the middle of something. If you finish a chapter, then you can come back 6 months later and take up the next part of the story, because each chapter is designed as a coherent whole. So it took me 4 years to write the book. I'm absolutely delighted by the production that Ignatius Press gave the book. They spared no expense in putting out a first-rate a product here for the public.
And I would absolutely agree with you. I'm actually flipping through the pictures now that are found in the center of the book, and like you said, there's 44 of them. And we broadcast here, Kevin, out of the Philadelphia, southern New Jersey area. So I was nice to see the picture here from St. Joseph's Church.
Isn't that beautiful? And doesn't it depict, Ken, if you look at that picture of St. Joseph's Church, doesn't it depict simultaneously Catholic devotionalism fused with the culture of 18th century Philadelphia? Because, of course, Philadelphia was the great, great, great city of North America, well into the 19th century. And I love this picture because imagine putting together a church like this by the 1730s. Isn't that remarkable that the Catholic culture of Philadelphia was that developed to be able to put a church together like this, and the fact that the church is still in use?
Right. Absolutely. And as I look at the picture, it looks like, like, as you mentioned, the architecture of the times, but also the things that I miss the most in some of our suburban parishes now, the old marble altar rails and the beautiful architecture within the church itself really lends itself to
devotions. People of a certain age, and I'm born 1940, this church from 1733 looks as familiar as the churches of the 1940s and 50s that I grew up in.
Sure, sure. And
then I have the picture down below from depicting Longfellow's poem, Evangeline, where Evangeline becomes the Acadians. Of course, the Acadians, when they were expelled from Canada, took refuge in Philadelphia. And the great story of Longfellow, how Evangeline is separated from her fiancé, and she becomes a nursing sister at the clinic there, connected to St. Mary's, next to St. Joseph, and then it discovers aged fiancé dying. It's a very powerful story. Whenever possible, I go into the artistic dimension. The beautiful picture I have of Emanuel Lutz, by Emanuel Lutz, who did Washington Crossing the Delaware, the founding of Maryland. That's a superb picture of which I secured from the Maryland Historical Society. And look at that lovely St. Mary's Chapel from St. Mary's County in Maryland from the 1640s. My goodness, it makes you realize how early the imprint of Catholic culture was on the North American continent and the cities of North America.
That it does. And you know what, in between our conversation and getting a look at a little bit of this book, I'm looking forward to reading it. And I'm really glad that you said it's not one you got to read all at once, because it may take me a while to plow through this.
It's a book to stay with.
Right.
You stay with it over a period of time. And especially I think it's underestimated. How do we make the distinction between Catholic tourism and Catholic pilgrimages? Well, the Europeans have a Catholic Europeans have a highly sense, and the Latin Americans do too, of going on pilgrimage. There are so many places for us North American Catholics to go on pilgrimage right in our own community. Look at the being a Californian, look at the surviving missions that I depict here, or the churches. Look at the pueblos, the chapels in southern New Mexico. There's the beautiful Ursuline convent in New Orleans, established in the 1720s, and the Ursuline Sisters, the school there. There's a sense, and whenever I can, people build a church in my narrative, I try and pay attention to that church. Look at those gorgeous Franciscan mission churches from the late 1500s in Florida. Those are reconstructions, but those are very elegant structures. And to put together the physical fabric of Catholic culture, to have places where the Blessed Sacrament can be reserved, where Mass can be given, all of that is an extraordinary achievement. A lot of it done before 1600.
Right. How about that? And it's something that's new to me. And look forward to learning more. One of the questions came to mind is when we look at we talked in the previous segment about New France and the rise of the Catholic Church in Canada, and then it seems to go from Canada to New Orleans.
And oh yes.
But was there anything in between, or was it?
Oh, it certainly was. First of all, you get up to Montreal. Then from Montreal, you move into the Great Lakes regions. And this is when we start to pay tribute to the great missionary orders involved in my narrative. The Jesuits, the Franciscan Recollects, the Franciscans Capuchins, the Sulpicians, the missionaries of the Paris Foreign Mission Society. These are extraordinary travelers and explorers as well as evangelizers. So you go to the Great Lakes, and then you begin to move down the Great Lakes into the Illinois River, the Northern Illinois Territory, coming down to the Missouri, and finally in the 1670s with Marquette, going down the Mississippi, and then finally in the 1720s, the establishment of New Orleans. So it's a 100-year epic of travel, transportation, settlement, evangelization, that creates that magnificent French Mississippi Valley, the Louisiana Territory, which we in the United States purchase. President Jefferson purchases from France in 1803. Purchases a second great Catholic region, if you will, is brought into the American Union. And in 1846, as a result of the Mexican War, you, of course, have the Spanish Southwest and California brought into the Union. So there's two major Catholic cultures that come in the 19th century into the American boundaries.
And again, it's this Catholic influence that's really pricking my mind, if you will, that something that I may have heard of, but going back through my history classes in high school and elementary school, not necessarily picking up on the Catholic flavor. Of course, we would have heard of Marquette and what have you, but really the Catholic background that would move the idea of Catholicism in New France from Canada, as you said, through the northern states.
Well, I try and introduce people like Fra Antonio Margel de Jesus, the Franciscan who moves into Texas, or Eusebio Kino, the Jesuit who goes into Arizona. I try and pay attention to these extraordinary missionaries, in many cases, who become really astonishing overland settlers, overland trekkers, opening up another way of saying it is that from the ashes of their campfires, cities have grown up, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to find the sort of origins, especially in the Southwest, of Native American places like Tucson, that then get a Spanish-type settlement goes there, and you begin to rise up to have the urbanization of places like Santa Fe, Tucson, and then coming into San Diego and finally San Francisco. I also try and pay attention to the European. We have to remember also during all this time, Europe is calling some of the major shots here. In other words, it's the French and the Spanish government that is also supplying, encouraging, protecting, organizing, paying for the extraordinary expenses of shipping across the Atlantic. So I don't overburden the reader with European history, but I give them enough of what's going on in Europe to explain the attention being paid by Europe, especially you mentioned New Orleans and the Mississippi Valley, by the attention being paid to this region for strategic purposes. Because the title of my book, Continental Ambitions, is also the ambitions that European powers have for the North American continent. You know, it wasn't fully decided until our own Revolutionary War how that was to be shaped out.
Right, because as you said, when Columbus would return with slaves and Queen Isabel would mention to him that that's not the reason that she had sent him on that voyage.
Right.
But,
and, you know, and Las Casas in one of his writings said, well, the Native Americans were weak. Maybe the African slaves are stronger. And for the rest of his life, he used to wake up in the middle of the night saying, oh, did I say that? Does that sound like I was approving of African slavery? And he had remorse. So even great saints can put their foot in their mouth and have remorse as a result.
Right, right.
Incidentally, I pay attention to formative women, like Margaret Brent, for instance, the great leader of the Catholic community in Maryland and in Virginia. And towards the end, I start focusing in on the Carroll family of Maryland, because they're going to play a major role in the American Revolution and in the establishment of the Catholic Church in 1790, following the American Revolution.
Very good. And one of the other things that perked my interest early on, when you were talking about, again, going back to the idea of having to bring families over and women over, and I'm assuming that that's so the Native Americans would see the European Catholic families and how they would operate and how they would live out their faith.
Well, you've pinpointed a very delicate continuing point of negotiation, because a vast majority of the Native American cultures were allowed some form of polygamy,
right?
Some form of marriage and divorce, or polygamy, and it became a very sensitive issue. The good news was, of course, is that most Native American cultures had a sense of the Great Spirit, of a great divinity beyond all gods and demons, and that became a point of agreement where evangelization could start with that concept, because it came close to the sense of the one true God. But in terms of, like you say, marriage and family life, it took a couple generations of Catholic culture to establish the model of a man, a wife, family, and marriage is an indissoluble covenant, a sacrament.
And the reason I found it interesting is because, you know, here we are a couple hundred years later, and in our culture today, it almost seems like we're in need of the same thing. As far as, you know, the Christian roots of this country, and I don't mean to take this into politics, but just where the country has come to a couple hundred years later, to where we need solid Catholic families today that would live out their faith and be examples. And really, for a Catholic family today, it's almost countercultural to live out our faith.
Well, I think that's all. That's very true, and I've always liked when I read, say, St. Paul, and St. Paul thanks the various Catholic women of the various communities spread throughout the Mediterranean, who facilitated his ministry. Or in the canon of the Mass, we mentioned the early women who were martyred, and the saints, and of course the very dramatic narrative in the Gospels of the crucifixion, when those who stayed beneath the cross were St. John, Mary, and the women who were followers of Jesus. This is why I pay close attention. I pay close attention to lay women in my narrative, and to the sisterhoods, the pioneer sisterhoods that came here, because you can't have a fulfilled Catholic life without all the seven sacraments being operative, to include the sacrament of matrimony.
Very good. Very good. We only have about 10 minutes left, and if less than that even. If anybody wants to get a last-minute call in, again, the number's here, 610-527-2906. That's 610-527-2906 and 888-343-2484. Again, our guest today is Dr. Kevin Starr, author of Continental Ambitions, Roman Catholics in North America, The Colonial Experience. And, you know, what I've gotten out of these last 50 minutes of being with you, Dr. Starr, is really how important the Catholic heritage of North, not just the United States, but of North America, has played in where we are today, but especially in the formation of the country, and whether it's downplayed intentionally in recent history, or not, is I guess another matter. But the point being that
it's my hope that this book will help. Help us, those who read it, and eventually over time, that we Catholics will come to a sense that we're not Johnny-come-lately. One of the things I documented in the book, Ken, is those moments when people create Catholic places, like, for instance, Sarah Boucher created a Catholic community there in French Canada, or some of the early Catholic communities formed in Bexar and in Texas. I come to that sense that Catholics were exploring a new landscape here, and in effect, the landscape was helping them grow in their faith and become better Catholics. But they, in turn, were Catholicizing the landscape. One of the pleasures of my being a Californian, for instance, is our landscape is just dotted with the Spanish names of the saints, the sacraments, and the mysteries of our Catholic culture. And that's part of the theme that I do here, the kind of environmental theme, the ecological theme. You don't come to a new place and stay in that new place for hundreds of years without that new place transforming you and enriching you, to include the enriching your sense of the sacred.
Very good. And we do have a caller on the line, Dr. Starr, so I'm going to go ahead and bring on Jerry. Hello, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. Hello, Dr. Starr. Yeah, I'm familiar with where you were from. I used to live in Sonoma, and I was startled. I went up and down 101, which is parallel to our 95, and you just had mentioned it, that even to this day, the names of all the towns of, you know, like Corpus Christi. And when I was up in New Hampshire, I saw a map of the United States, an old map, and the whole Canada, the United States, and Mexico were all named after various saints. And the Mississippi River was named after the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Yes, yes.
And I didn't know if that was brought up, but the thing is, it just reminded me of all that. And the thing is, there's an actual map somewhere with all these names of saints and...
Well, Jerry, here I'm here in San Francisco now, and here in California,
right. 70%. Well, I used to live in Sonoma. I was 50 miles north of you.
Sonoma is a beautiful city. 70% of the population of California still lives in the footprint of Spanish California and Mexican
right.
California.
In other words,
and Hispanic California is not gone. It's alive and well in the Hispanic peoples of California. It's also alive and well. And what you suggest, the El Camino Real, the 101
right.
coastal highway.
And but I was even surprised that the Mississippi was named after the Blessed Virgin Mary. I wanted to share that.
The Mississippi itself is the Native American name that then was brought forward. But yes, and even rivers that didn't exist, the San Buenaventura, for instance, the Spanish were constantly looking for a river that would start somewhere around Colorado mm-hmm. and move west and go into the Pacific. They just hoped they could find that to find a fast way into the Pacific region, and they called it the Saint Bonaventure after the great Franciscan theologian Saint Bonaventure. Unfortunately, that river, like the Northwest Passage, never was discovered because it was never there.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for having the grace to take the time out to write this book and share this with everyone.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you for that.
I wrote it for readers like yourself. Okay.
Thank you. Eventually, I'll come across it. Thank you for doing that and sharing this and making us realize our history, our spiritual history in this continent.
Very good. Jerry, I want to thank you for picking up the phone and give us a call. We appreciate it.
Okay. I'm going to hang up for now, and I'll just listen in.
Very good. God bless you now.
You too.
All right. So, very interesting. I want to thank Jerry for picking up the phone. I would have never thought that Mississippi River...
That's a welcome call. Jerry, of course, was from Sonoma, which was one of the last of the missions to be founded.
How about that? But I never would have known that the Mississippi River was named for the Blessed Virgin Mary. And that's not the... Was it the Mississippi originally, or obviously not, right?
You know, the Mississippi is an Indian name that predominated. But what Jerry is suggesting that as there was a report of a great river out there, say the French Canadians or the Spaniards would name it already even before they found it, and they would tend to name it after in religious terms.
Very good, very good. So, Dr. Starr, it's been a pleasure to be with you for these last 55 minutes or so. And again, the name of the book is Continental Ambitions: Roman Catholics in North America, The Colonial Experience. It's published by Ignatius Press, available at ignatius.com, and also on Amazon as well. Any final words for us, Dr. Starr, before you leave us?
Well, just, Ken, that you live, your broadcast emanates from a great epicenter of Catholic civilization. You mentioned St. John Newman. You can mention St. Catherine Drexel. The great religious history of Philadelphia, the Catholic history of Philadelphia, the revolutionary Catholic Revolutionary War leaders that came out of Philadelphia, like Stephen Moylan. It's a remarkable city. I we all love our own city, but then we have special favorites, and Philadelphia is one of mine.
Very good. Very good. If you're ever in the area, you need to look us up here at In His Sign, and maybe we can do another show together and meet you in person. But wonderful to have you, and I hope many of our listeners will turn around today and go out and pick up this book. Again, Continental Ambitions: Roman Catholics in North America by Dr. Kevin Starr.
Or if they can't spend the money, ask their local public library to purchase it.
Better yet,
it could be good book for the library to have.
Very good. Thank you again, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, and I'm sure our listeners were happy to hear you. So thanks for being with us, and hopefully we'll connect again in the future.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
God bless now. So that was Dr. Kevin Starr, and it's always nice to learn something new and to learn about all this Catholic history that was unknown to me before today, and I'm sure to many of our listeners. So I want to thank Dr. Starr for being with us. Again, it's always my pleasure to be with you for a couple hours here each Wednesday with Saints and Sinners and what the world needs now. And what the world needs now is love, and that means we need you, our listeners, and maybe you happened upon us for the first time today and learned a little bit about our Catholic heritage. And maybe there's some that are interested in becoming Catholic. If you are, you can always find us on Google now. I'd say look us up on the Yellow Pages, but not too many people have the Yellow Pages anymore. But look us up online and find a local parish. Maybe check in and learn more about the Catholic faith. For those that are Catholic and away from the church, we need you now more than ever. Come on back. So again, my pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Until then, take care, and God bless.